So today we're going to continue our discussion from last time. And so last time we saw that perturbation theory can break down. And we also saw that it can miss some effects. So it can't, the perturbation theory we developed last time can't see any effect that goes like e to the minus a over lambda, where a here is some constant. And lambda is a small parameter. So we could have in mind that lambda is h bar, which we would treat as a small parameter if we're interested in the classical or semi-classical limit. Or lambda could be a small parameter that describes how close we are to a free theory we can solve exactly. And it could, for example, be one of the parameters in a potential. So any effect that goes like e to the minus a over lambda is invisible in perturbation theory. And one reason for that is that all terms in the Taylor series of e to the minus a over lambda are zero around lambda equals zero. So we can't see any effect that goes like e to the minus one over lambda using a technique that involves a Taylor series. Nevertheless, there are a number of important effects in physics that go like e to the minus one over lambda in some parameter. So a few of the most important examples are quantum tunneling and energy splitting. I mean, degenerate energy levels in a quantum system. So one example, to elaborate on the first example of quantum tunneling, you can imagine a potential where there's some barrier, V of X versus X. And if a particle is moving to the right and doesn't have enough energy to classically go over the barrier, quantum mechanically, there's still a some probability that the particle will tunnel through the barrier. And so one way to quantify how likely the particle is to tunnel through the barrier versus be reflected is to compute the transmission coefficient. And it can be shown, for example, by computing the wave function, perhaps using some approximation like the WKB approximation, if you're familiar with that, that the transmission coefficient, or it's the probability that the particle will tunnel through, goes like the exponential minus 2 over h bar times an integral. 2m. So the tunneling or the transmission coefficient is exponentially small in h bar. So in this semi-classical limit, if we're doing type of perturbation theory that we developed last time, there's no way we could describe this effect. And similarly, so another example where quantum tunneling is important, if we have a metastable state. So here again is another potential V of X. And here, this potential I've sketched has a local minimum and is unbounded from below. So if we have a particle that starts out here, eventually it will tunnel through the barrier and go off to plus infinity. And in this case, the parameter we would, or physical observable we could compute to characterize the system would be the decay rate. And again, this is exponentially small in H bar. So formula is almost exactly the same as before. So this is telling right. Can't be seen if you do perturbation theory around this point. And this case is the case we're going to focus on today. And what we're going to do is to compute this decay rate using path integrals. And so we'll learn a few things. So one is we'll see a very different way to think about this tunneling problem. So we're going to compute this decay rate using path integrals. So we'll see, in a sense, what types of paths contribute in the leading approximation to this process. So we'll gain some conceptual understanding there. We'll also understand more completely how and why the perturbation theory broke down from last time, and what the reason for that is, and how to fix it. So we'll elaborate on what we saw last time there. And one advantage of the method we're going to use today, using path integrals to compute this, is that the methods we're going to use will generalize much more easily to higher dimensions. So we'll see that it's somewhat more slightly more involved to compute this in one dimension than a method using the wave function. But in higher dimensions, if you want to find the wave function, to find a wave function in higher dimensions, you have to solve a differential equation in higher dimensions, and that becomes much more difficult. So this is hard to find in higher dimensions. And particularly in quantum field theory, it becomes extremely difficult to use wave function based methods solving it. Quantum field theory is essentially like an infinite dimensional limit on quantum mechanics. So wave function based techniques are very difficult in quantum field theory, whereas the methods we'll describe will generalize rather easily. So we'll focus today on the tunneling applications, but most of what I'm going to say will apply equally well to the energy splitting problem. So if I've got a potential here that has, these local minima are supposed to be degenerate. So classically, there are two ground states, two lowest energy states. And quantum mechanically, the two lowest energy levels will be approximately degenerate, but they'll be split by some small amount, E plus minus E minus. And again, the splitting will be exponentially small in H bar. So that's another application that we're not going to discuss as much today, but very, very similar considerations will apply to that that problem as well. Okay. So that's where we're going, and the way we're going to approach this. So our main object we've been studying over the last few classes is the propagator, which we can write as a path integral in imaginary time. It's just the integral over all paths minus the Euclidean action of of tau. And the way we're going to extract the tunneling rate is by studying the propagator. And we can relate the propagator to the tunneling rate in two steps. So first, as we discussed before, we can compute the ground state energy from the propagator. And today we're going to use a slight variation of the formula we looked at before. So we saw that the ground state energy written as a limit as beta goes to infinity, 1 over beta, times the log of Ke of a propagator that was periodic. So I'm going to make two small changes to what we did before. So this would be plus. So one small change, or one change I'm making, is I'm shifting our time interval to make it symmetric. And the propagator only depends on the time interval. So here, this is a propagator from the initial position Q naught at initial time minus beta h bar over 2 to the final time beta h bar over 2. So I'm shifting that. That will make some of our discussion later when we actually look for the paths slightly easier just because of the symmetry. But because propagator only depends on the time interval, I can shift the initial time. And I'm going to make it symmetric around 0. So that's one change I'm making. So that's a smaller change. The second change I'm making is more significant, but ultimately it won't matter. So before, we had an integral over the initial and final position, which were the same as periodic. I'm not putting that integral now. And that means that this is we're no longer writing the ground state energy as the limit of 1 over beta of log z, the partition function. Partition function has to have that integral. But the difference is subleading in this limit and goes to 0. So the way, so we can write this propagator as, so we're looking at the propagator from Q naught to Q naught. And here we have e to the minus beta h. If we insert this identity that we insert a complete set of energy eigenstates here, then this e to the minus beta h becomes e to the minus beta ej. And then Ke becomes the sum of j e to the minus beta ej times the absolute value of q naught j squared. So that's different from what we had before we just had the sum of e to the minus beta ej. But this extra factor, q naught j squared, is independent of beta. And so in this limit that, once we take the log, we'll get plus an extra term that's independent of beta. Once we divide by beta, that term will go to 0. So that doesn't matter. And in fact, we could write this with any choice of initial and final position. They wouldn't even have to be the same. So this formula works regardless of what choice we make for the initial and final position. Okay, so we can go from once we compute the propagator, we can extract the ground state energy from the propagator. And then what we're interested in computing is the decay rate. And so we're looking at this problem. Metastable state, P of X. Which is X. And so this is a system that doesn't actually have a ground state. I'm assuming it's unbounded from below. So what we really mean here, it doesn't have a bound state, but it does have what are known as resonance states. Which are quantized complex energies. So they're defined by wave functions that have outgoing wave functions only, outgoing components only. And the way to extract the decay rate from this energy is the decay rate is the 2 times the absolute value of the imaginary part of the ground state energy. And the way to understand that is that if we have a would-be ground state, so in that evolves, if it's an energy eigenstate, it evolves in time, like E in real time, like E to the I, E naught T. And so if E naught is real, the probability that you remain in the ground state, if you start in the ground state, is 1. This is a complex number of magnitude 1. If you take a magnitude squared, you'll get 1.
I have a question.
Yes, Sarah.
So is it not a problem that we don't have a ground state so that it's unbounded from below? Is that a problem? And also, is this like somehow connected to us using the imaginary energy E naught for our decay rate?
Okay, so to answer your second question first, yes, it is connected. The fact that it's not bounded from below means that, yes, our Hamiltonian is not Hermitian and doesn't have real eigenvalues. So that's connected. And whether it's a problem that it's not bounded from below is, the answer is both yes and no. It depends on what we're trying to calculate. So there are questions we can ask about the system where it doesn't matter. And this system is not bounded from below and doesn't have a ground state. And one question that is valid to ask about this is what's the decay rate? That's a well-defined question. And in a sense, you can think about this as an approximation to a more physical system where the potential looks like this and has some minimum that's very far away. So if we just look at the tunneling rate, that whatever is going on far away shouldn't affect it very much. And mathematically, it turns out to be easier here. You're right to be concerned that absolutely that there are lots of questions you can ask about this system that don't make sense because it's not bounded from below.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. So the probability to remain in the ground state is 1. I'm going back to what I was saying before, is 1 if E naught is real. But if E naught has an imaginary part, then the probability of remaining in the ground state will no longer be 1 because this will no longer be a complex number of magnitude 1. And so the probability of remaining in the ground state will decay with respect to time. E naught has a ground state, and that's what one way to think about the ORD, this relationship between the decay rate and the ground state energy in quotations. It's not really a ground state energy, it's the energy of the would be ground state. So that's where we're going to go. So we're going to use path integrals to compute the propagator. Propagator is related to the ground state energy, which is related to the carrier. Okay. So, but our main challenge is to compute the propagator using path integrals. Okay. And so the way we're going to do this, let's go back and think about this example we studied last time of this one-dimensional real integral. We can think about this either as, like, if we discretize the path integral, think about this as one segment. So we're trying to understand one segment first before we understand the full path integral, or you can just think about this as a toy model. For the system we're looking at. And so what we saw last time is that if we had some function f of x that had a local minimum, or f prime x is 0 and f double prime positive, then we could, then the most important contributions to this integral come from a region near this minimum. And we could Taylor expand f in the exponent and write I as approximately the integral of e to the minus ax squared plus c 1 plus n. So where a here is essentially the second derivative at the minimum, and c was the value of the function at the minimum. And the higher order terms in the Taylor expansion of x of f near the minimum, we Taylor expanded the exponential to get for the correction. That's what we did last time.
Then I have a question.
Yes, Diana?
Yes. The that value that is the most important, it only yes. has to be a minimum, right? It doesn't have to be the function evaluated. It has to be zero, or it can be like anywhere in the space. It just has to be a minimum.
It just has to be a minimum. Yes. So
also for the state, right?
It doesn't have to be at zero.
Okay, thank you.
So we're not doing gravitational physics here. So often it's convenient if it's not at zero to shift the whole potential up and down, which doesn't change any physics if we're doing non-gravitational physics, but could do the whole calculation where potential shifted up and down, or there might be multiple minima where some are at zero and some are not at zero.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so so this is the approximation we could do in that case, and we saw that in general this is an asymptotic series. So if we go to high enough order, eventually this breaks down, and we saw we can miss effects that are exponentially small. So we can also consider the case, which we discussed a little bit last time, but let's look at it in some more detail, where there are multiple minima. And let's consider the case where there are multiple minima of f that where the minima are the same value. Here I've drawn a sketch of f, where there are two minima, both with f prime equal to 0 and f double prime positive. So in that case, you can write I as a sum over xi. So there are two important regions then in the integral, the region near each of the minima. So we write this as a sum, Taylor expand around each of the minima separately and add together those contributions. We get here's exponential minus 1 over h bar f of xi plus a half f double prime xi x minus xi squared. And then if we went to higher order, we could expand that exponential and write it something like that. And so if we look at these integrals, right, can do these integrals and can write the total contribution to the integral I as the sum over the minima e to the minus f of xi over h bar. So this constant term will just come out of the integral. And then the rest of the integral will give us, from the higher order terms in the Taylor expansion of f, will give us some multiplicative factor, which I'll just call n of xi. So here we see something that's exponentially small. So if we just do a Taylor series around one minimum, there's no way to see the other minimum, but if we sum over both minima, we get something that's exponentially small with respect to an expansion around the other one. So these are our exponentially small effects. They come from, one way to think about where they can come from is from the different minima. So if we include all the minima, we can see these exponentially small effects. So here, this is our exponentially small. Term, and this n accounts for the fluctuations around each of the minima. Okay, so that's essentially where these exponential effects can come from. They can come from different minima. So if we include all of the minima, then we can see that we can get exponentially small effects. So in the path integral, it's the same story. So last time we explored an analogy between the path integral and this toy integral. And so if I want to take this formula for I and write the path integral version, the propagator is like the integral I. The minima are like the classical paths, which I'm going to write as q bar. So q bar is the same as what I wrote as qc last time. We're going to be adding other subscripts to q later on, so I'm going to rename it q bar so we don't have multiple subscripts. Apologies for changing notation, but that's the same thing before. Then we've got exponential, so f here is the function that was in the integral, that's like the action. And then we also have some factor that accounts for the fluctuations around those classical solutions to the equations in Euclidean time. And so this is our formula for the propagator in terms of the classical paths. And so that's what we're going to look for today, are these solutions to the classical equations of motion. So the classical paths are the analogs of the minima. And that's what we need to find in order to compute the propagator in this approximation. And so again, we're going to focus on this metastable state where the potential looks something like this. And I'm going to draw it again just to make it a little more, to label it a little bit more carefully. So I'm going to assume that this local minimum is at Q naught. And for simplicity, I'm going to assume that V of Q naught is zero. Oh, that's V, not V prime. So it's a minimum. So V prime is also zero, but I'll make the additional assumption that V of Q is zero. And V double prime of Q, I'll give that a name, omega squared. So we'll say that it locally, if we look at a region near Q naught, it looks like a harmonic oscillator with characteristic angular frequency omega.
Just to be clear, this Q here is still a path, right?
Q here is a path, yes.
Okay, so we shouldn't take this diagram too literally. It's okay, cool.
So Q at a particular time is the location of the particle. So Q. The function Q is a trajectory. It's the history of the particle. But at one particular time, we can ask, where is the particle? And it'll be somewhere, and its potential, it'll have some potential.
Okay, so it does actually make sense to draw a Q axis as long as we do so at a particular time.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, and I will also assume that the other point where V of Q is zero is some point Q star. Okay. So in order to compute the decay rate, which is 2 times the imaginary part ground state energy, and the ground state energy is the minus the limit beta goes to infinity 1 over beta log ke. I need to choose which points our propagator or the initial and final position for our propagator. And I'm going to make the choice. The initial and final positions are Q naught. So for now, that's a choice. In the breakout rooms, one of the final questions will ask you to think about that choice and why it's not really a choice. Any other choice doesn't make this approximation work. But for now, we'll just assume that the initial and final positions are Q naught. And again, I'm going to take the time, final time to be beta h bar over 2, and the initial time to be minus beta h bar over 2. So the time interval is still beta h, but we just shifted it to make it symmetric. That makes solving the equations a little bit easier. So what we need to do in order to find this propagator and the approximation we're making is we need to find the classical paths. So that is, we need to solve the equation of motion. So here we're dealing with a particle in a potential, and our equation of motion is minus m dq d squared q d tau squared plus b prime of q bar is equal to 0. And our boundary conditions are determined by the initial and final position of the particle in the propagator. So here we're looking at a propagator from Q naught at time t equals minus beta h bar over t, and ending up at the same position at time beta h bar over t. So we should impose the boundary conditions, the Q bar at plus or minus TE over 2 is equal to Q naught. So these are the equations we need to solve, and we're going to do that in the breakout room. So one thing to point out is that our approximation only makes sense or if the action of our solutions is finite. So any solution with infinite action doesn't contribute in this approximation. E to the minus infinity is zero. So we want to look for finite action solutions to these equations. And such finite action solutions are known as instant times. For reasons we'll discuss after you construct them in the breakout rooms. So that's what we're looking for, our finite action solutions to these equations of motion. Oh, and we're gonna make one further simplification. We'll take M equals one, just to simplify the math a little bit. Okay, so now we're gonna go to the breakout rooms and you will solve these equations and look at the solutions to try to understand how we can construct the path integral in this approximation. Afterwards, we'll discuss together how to go from those solutions. First we'll discuss what the solutions look like, and then we'll discuss how to go from those solutions to do the last few steps to get to the decay rate. Okay, so the problems are in the Google Drive as usual. I will send you to the breakout rooms in just a minute. So what we're looking for are solutions to the equations of motion with finite action. And our equations of motion are the equations of motion for a particle moving in an inverted potential minus V. That's because we have an extra minus sign in our equation of motion because we're treating time as imaginary. So there's a trivial solution where the particle, so our inverted potential looks like this. Here's Q naught, here's minus V. So there's a trivial solution where the particle just sits at Q naught for all time. There's also a solution where the particle starts at Q naught, rolls to the right over to Q star, and bounces back. And so that solution will look something like plot Q bar, a function of tau. Here's Q naught, Q star. Since the potential is very flat near Q naught, Q naught is the local maximum, it will take an exponentially long time for the particle to roll away from Q naught. Then it will, as it moves here, it will get more and more kinetic energy. So it'll move faster, approach Q naught and bounce back, and then be exponentially close to Q naught again for a long time. And where this is minus TE over 2, this is TE over 2, and we're interested in the limit where TE goes to infinity. So this solution is sometimes called a bounce. It's an instanton. It's a solution to the equations of motion that has finite action. And the reason we can argue that it has finite action is, well, the action is the integral d tau of a half dq d tau squared plus v. And so Q is exponentially close to Q naught. And its derivative is also exponentially small for most of the time. So in this region where Q is near Q naught, both the kinetic energy and the potential energy are very small. So both of these terms are negligible, except in this region where the particle approaches Q star. So to leading approximation, it's zero except in this small region, and it's exponentially small, so it is finite. We can integrate something that goes to zero exponentially small from minus infinity to infinity. So that is a solution to the equations of motion, and it has some finite action. So SE of that solution has some finite action, which I'll call S naught. There are other solutions to the equations of motion. So this solution is the particle going rolling down here and bouncing back. We could also have a solution where the particle bounces multiple times. So it could roll from Q naught to Q star, back to Q naught, and so on. So it could basically put copies of this solution next to each other.
We have a question, Dan, from Dario, I guess.
Yes, Dario.
I was just a little bit concerned. Sorry, this is probably better. I was just a little bit concerned about the fact that we made this approximation for our behavior that gave us this exponential. And we say, yes, it's okay, we can integrate this exponential. But how do we know that perhaps the error of that approximation is not something that we can't integrate over an infinite region? For instance, how do we know that the error of that integral is negligible? Or even bounded, for that matter.
So in principle, that's something you'd want to check. You can... I think there's several ways you could go about doing that. You could go to the next order in the Taylor series approximation of Q and show that that it works, or you could find numerically solve these equations of motion and find that there are solutions that do look like essentially like this that are approximately exponentially small here.
Okay. Cool.
So there are a number of ways to check that. It works out. I don't think it's not something I could show in a couple of lines, but it does. End up being a good approximation. So we can have solutions that bounce multiple times. Which I'll call Qn. So that's a solution that bounces n times. And the action of such a solution should be approximately just n times the action of the one bound solution. Because essentially all of the contribution to the action comes from this region where the particle is far away from Q naught. That's the only time it has a non-negligible kinetic energy or non-negligible potential energy. So those are our classical solutions. And if we want to compute the path integral, we need to sum over all of our solutions to the equations of motion. So there of course will be this factor n that accounts for fluctuations around each of these solutions. I'm just going to write ke because I'm not going to write down those the fluctuation terms, but the path integral in this approximation, we should sum over all of our solutions. So we've got, we can have any number of bounces between 0 and infinity. And we should sum over the action of each of our solutions, which is n s naught over h bar. But we haven't quite counted all of our all the solutions, because in fact, each of these solutions we found is a family of solutions, because I have not yet labeled the location of the center, or the location where the time at which the particle reaches q star. In the tau goes to infinity limit, that time could be anywhere. Our solution should be time translation invariant. We can be able to shift our solution by any region. And likewise, our solutions with n bounces, it could reach q star at any time. So each of these is actually a family of solutions, and we should account for the location of any possible time that the particle can reach q star. So that means that in the case where we just have one bounce, we should get a factor here of TE. That's the integral over any, we should sum over all the possible locations where the particle reaches Q star. And if we have N particles and N bounces, the particle reaches Q star N times, we get a factor here of TE to the N over N factorial. Comes from integrating over all the possible times that the particle could reach Q star. And this is just the Taylor expansion for an exponential. So KE is, in this approximation, a double exponential. So there's some constant here because I haven't included the constant of the overall normalization. And that comes from the higher order terms in the expansion of the action around the classical solutions. And so if we want to get the yes, Dario?
Forgive me, I'm a little confused about this n bounce solution, because each of these bounces takes infinite time.
Yes.
And you're saying that there can be n of them, and that moreover it can reach q star at any time, and we have to integrate over the time at which it reaches q star.
Yes.
I'm just struggling to make sense of that. How do we think of finitely many infinite time bounces that can happen at any time? I'm just not entirely sure I understand what that means.
Well, so really they should be well separated, but to a good approximation that wouldn't change. If we have two bounces that can be anywhere and we integrate over all possible times where the particle reaches Q star, most of the time we're counting is when they're far away. If the two, okay, if they're infinitely far away, then it has time to reach Q naught with zero velocity and go start over.
So this is an approximation for the physical scenario in which these bounces happen in finite but very long time.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
This approximation. So to get the decay rate from this, we need to take the logarithm and divide by TE. And so we get that the K rate is, so the logarithm divided by t just gives us e to the minus s naught over h bar, which can be shown that s naught can be written as an integral. If we do a change of variables instead of integrating over t, we do a change of variables to integrate over q instead. The action can be written as, get a 2 integral 2v dq, which is the same formula I had before. So we reproduce the familiar result, or perhaps familiar result from using the wave function, but we see that we can understand this decay rate as originating from paths where the particle basically goes through the barrier multiple times, or potentially multiple times, in imaginary time. So these are the classical paths that contribute to this tunneling. They're literally paths that go through the barrier, which is what we expect. So that's our key result for today. And I'm out of time, but next time we're going to go back to real time and discuss some applications of topology to path integrals. So that's, we'll see you next time. I'll stick around if there are more questions. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe I just wanted to finish what we were discussing with Diana and Sajak before we got interrupted, but that's, we were talking about the usefulness of imaginary time, but Dan just said it. It's one of the good reasons to use it is because you transform the problem of looking for decay rates into something that is just classical physics in a reverse potential somehow. You just have to use what you know, but you just put the minus sign on the potential, use imaginary time, but this, the what you know about just Newton's law and how to, what's the action of a particle that moves in such a well, it translates to quantities that we're interested in for potential barriers, for example. Yeah, so, but Dan said it too. So.
Thanks, Remy.
Here now.
Thank you, Remy. And thank you, Dan.
Yep, thank you.